That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 8. Agonism. Programmed contentiousness, ritualized opposition.
In this lecture, I want to talk about one of my favorite topics in conversational style, and that's the concept of agonism. That's ritualized opposition. I get the term agonism from Walter Ong, who has written a book about it called Fighting for Life. Agonism is ritualized opposition. It comes from the Greek term agon for war, but it's not literal war. It's ritualized opposition, where we use warlike formats to accomplish interaction that are not literally fighting. Ong defines it as programmed contentiousness or ceremonial combat. In other words, it's a kind of ritualized adversativeness. So, for example, debate is a kind of ritualized, formalized fight rather than perhaps a dialogue or discussion. Sports, play fighting, teasing are all forms of agonism. Now, Walter Ong claims that agonism plays a greater role in the consciousness and social interaction of boys and men. And that's true, and I'll have some comments on that. But there is also a very large cultural component. And so different cultural groups and speakers of different languages have very different habits for using agonism, that is, ritualized adversativeness, to accomplish all kinds of interactions. Let me start with the role of agonism in boys' culture. Boys frequently will use opposition or play fighting as a way of negotiating friendship, and they are somewhat more likely to do this than girls. In fact, if you look at little boys and little girls at play, starting with preschoolers, you'll see that boys will frequently play fight. It isn't that girls don't fight. They do fight, but they don't fight for fun. That wouldn't be their favorite game. A mother of a little boy commented to me, she said, I have a friend who has a little girl, and when my friend's girl wants to play, she'll say, you be the baby and I'll be the mommy. When my little boy wants to play, he says, you be the monster and chase me. By the way, I recently told this story to a mother of a little boy, and she said, she laughed, and she said her little boy was playing with a little girl. The little girl said, you be the mommy, I'll be the baby. And the little boy said, good, and then I'll hit you. The mother was a bit horrified. I want to read you an example from a study that was done by William Corsaro and Thomas Rizzo. They studied preschool boys and girls at play in the United States and in Italy. The little part that I want to read to you here shows how these little preschool boys use fighting as a way of making a friendship, getting into play with each other. The two boys, their names are Richard and Denny, have been playing with a slinky. And you know that little toy, a slinky? It's a spiral, metal spiral, and you put it on the stairs and it kind of goes down the stairs by itself as the spiral unfolds. So they're playing with a slinky in the stairwell leading up to the playhouse. They're in school, in a preschool. So while they're playing, two other boys named Joseph and Martin enter, and they stand near the bottom of the stairs. So Denny says, go. Well, Martin runs off, but Joseph stays. And eventually he moves halfway up the stairs. And this is how the interaction goes. Little boy Joseph, the intruder, says, these are big shoes. Richard says, I'll punch him right in the eye. Joseph, I'll punch you right in the nose. Denny, I'll punch him with my big fist. Joseph, Richard, and he'll be bumpity-bumpity and punched out all the way down the stairs. Joseph, I could poke your eyes out with my gun. I have a gun. Denny, a gun? Richard, I have a gun too. Denny, and I have guns too, and it's bigger than yours, and it's poo-poo down. That's poo-poo. And then all the boys laugh, because Denny's referred to poo-poo. Richard, now leave. Joseph, uh-uh. I'm going to tell you to put on the gun on your hair and the poop will come right out on his face. Denny, well, Richard, slinky will snap right on your face too. Denny, and my gun will snap right. So up until this point, I really had no trouble when I was reading this, interpreting the interaction, right? The boys were engaged in a fight. But pretty soon, Corsaro and Rizzo explain that they just ended up playing together happily in the house. So picking a fight was the way that the new boy, Joseph, could get into the play. by picking a fight, he started an interaction that they both knew how to do, and they were then able to reframe it, to use that word framing, to reframe it as play. I saw a similar thing happen not too long ago. I actually was at a restaurant that had an outdoor picnic area. It was right by the water where people were buying their food and taking it out and sitting at the tables and eating. And I saw this interaction. There was a little girl. Oh, she was maybe 3 or 4 years old, and she was happily standing on her own eating an ice cream cone. And suddenly a little boy came hurtling over toward her and kind of clasped her waist in his two hands. And the girl immediately began crying. And she went over to her father crying. And the father apparently knew both the boy and the girl, and he chastised the boy not to make the girl cry. And the boy kept running around. He was obviously very exuberant, and he ran over to a little boy and did exactly the same thing. Ran up to him and sort of clasped his hands around the waist, and the boy shoved him away, and he shoved him back, and pretty soon they were roughhousing and they were playing together. And it seemed crystal clear to me that when he ran over to the little girl, he was trying to engage her in play. But that's not how she was inclined to play, and so she was put off by it and thought she was being attacked. She took it literally as an attack. And this is what we always find when you don't understand a conversational or interactional ritual as a ritual, you take it literally. And that's what often happens in girls' reaction to boys' use of agonism. Here's a similar example, and it's older young women and men. This actually took place among college kids, and this comes from a field note written by a student in one of my classes, Anthony Marchese. And this is what he described. They're playing a game called Jenga, a game of blocks, and he's playing with two friends. We played about 3 or 4 games, and then we started building things with the blocks. It was really fun because we felt like little kids again. There were 3 of us building our own little structures, 2 guys and 1 girl, Alicia. We had each built a unique design when suddenly the other guy threw a block at my structure to knock it over. It only glanced my building, and for the most part, it stayed up. I then threw a block at his building, which prompted him to throw a block at Alicia's. She put her arms around her building to shield it from the flying blocks. While my friend and I destroyed each other's buildings, we couldn't get hers because we did not want to hit her with the blocks. Another guy in the room said to her, "Why didn't you throw blocks at them?" She said she did not like to play that way and she did not find our play very amusing. I did not want my building ruined, but I had a lot of fun throwing blocks at my friends and destroying his. I love this because it really captures the spirit of agonism. The fun, from Anthony's point of view, of destroying each other's buildings, which was just as much fun as building the buildings in the first place. It wasn't something that Alicia thought was fun, but it was something that the young men thought was fun. So it's agonism because it's a warlike structure. They are attacking each other, but it's a ritual attack, and it's not meant literally. Physical roughhousing has a verbal analog, and that would be insults, hurling insults, similar to hurling blocks. I'm going to illustrate that with another field note, and this one was written by Janine Jacob. This is what Janine wrote. "This weekend, I hung out with some of my male friends from high school who were visiting D.C. Even though these individuals are going to Ivy League universities, they continue to roughhouse and make fun of each other just like they did in high school. They gave each other nicknames like Fat Ass, Loser, Asswipe, and El Lardo." And by the way, she tells me there were worse, but these were the ones that she felt comfortable putting in her field note. "They would trade insults until one member would change the subject, become offended, or physically attack the other guys." Now, this is really kind of funny because this, as she goes on here, she shows how the young men react when she tries to tell them that she thinks what they're doing is agonism. "During one particularly rough exchange of insults, I told my friends what I learned in my class. I told them that while men use agonism, ritualized conflict, to show intimacy and affection, women tend to avoid this type of conflict. One of the guys agreed with the statement and hugged his friend, saying, 'We tease because we love.' They proceeded to apologize for hurting the feelings of the other guys, telling them how much they really cared for one another. And eventually the apology turned into another wrestling match." So this field note illustrates again the use of attacks as a way of showing friendship. And in the one I just read by Janine Jacob, you can see how physical and verbal agonism are intertwined. And I've shown in some of these examples that it tends to be men more than women that use agonism or ritual attack as a way of showing affection. But certainly women can use it too. And so now I want to read you an example of a field note written by a woman. This field note was written by Tracy Jarman. And she says, "My roommate Charisse and I were playing computer games one night when our friend Liz came over to visit. Charisse and I got into several teasing arguments in the course of the evening. Most of the arguments involved someone being called stinky or worse. Liz lives with three other girls but does not really consider them to be good friends. Liz commented on the social dynamics of our apartment. 'You guys are so different. My apartment mates would not even joke around like that. Oh, they are so boring.' In fact, my other apartment mates also participate in this ritual agonism, and it makes life hilarious. Nat stole my favorite teddy bear last week. Tiffany can be seen wielding a pillow and chasing Nat around the house on a nightly basis. Everyone thinks we're crazy and always at each other's throats, but we're really showing that we care. So when I give Charisse a hard time for not eating red meat, I'm being cruel on the propositional level, but on the relational level, I'm showing that Charisse and I are such close friends, we can joke about things like that. I'm not sure how Liz's apartment mates would react if they had to live with us, but as long as everyone in my apartment participates in the ritual agonism, we get along just fine." So here's an example of young women who trade insults and physically play fight. On the one hand, you could comment that both the insults are not as extreme. She's saying they call each other stinky or worse, which isn't as extreme as what we heard the boys calling each other. And the physical roughhousing also might not be quite as rough. But they are using opposition or agonism as a way of showing affection. Now, it might not be a coincidence that Tracy Jarman and her roommates are African-American. There does seem to be some indication that there are cultural differences here. So I said earlier that playful insults are more common among Italian-American, Greek-American, and African-American speakers. And so that could be one of the things functioning here. A pattern that came up in a number of field notes written by my various students is that those who come from backgrounds or for whatever reason use agonism or playful opposition as a way of showing friendship sometimes get negative reactions from other women. And I'll read an example of a field note that says that. This was written by a student named Julie Sweetland, and Julie writes, "I grew up in a very confrontational family. My mother refuses to agree with anything. And I also lived several years in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. Between the two, I guess I've turned out pretty argumentative, but only among close friends. I found that using this style with mostly white students at Georgetown creates problems. For example, a girl got assigned to our apartment and left after a semester. Although I had tried my best to make friends with her, that often entailed disagreeing with her. When she left, she said she had often felt intimidated by me. I said, 'I'm 5'2 and weigh 100 pounds. How could I possibly intimidate you?' And she said, 'Just like that.'" So this example supports both contentions, both on the one hand that women can also engage in agonism just as much as men can, but also that sometimes she gets a more negative reaction from her female peers. So we see here that the use of agonism or ritualized opposition can vary by gender. But there's also a tremendous cultural influence on agonism, and perhaps the cultural influence overrides the gender one. In his book, Fighting for Life, Walter Ong traces our Western fascination with adversativeness to Aristotle and to the Greeks in general. He contrasts this with Chinese philosophers' emphasis on harmony. In fact, he uses the term Irenism, from the Greek word Irene for peace, Irenism as the opposite of agonism. Whereas in many cultures, and I think for Walter Ong, all Western cultures would be more this way than Asian cultures, there's a positive value placed on opposition. For Asian cultures or Eastern cultures, there would be a positive value placed on harmony and finding at least the open expression of agreement. And let me say quickly here, it's not that any culture disagrees more or agrees more. We all, in our communication day to day, sometimes we agree, sometimes we disagree, sometimes we feel positive, sometimes we feel negative. That's why the terms agonism and eirenism refer to ritualized opposition or harmony. It just refers to the way your language and your culture give you pre-formatted, programmed in a way, ways of expressing either agonism on one hand or eirenism on the other. Heidi Burns is a linguist who has looked at differences in style among speakers of German and speakers of American English. She's a professor at an American university and frequently prepares American students to study in Germany and then works with them when they come back. A pattern that she observed is that American students in Germany frequently feel insulted and offended by German students who try to engage them in animated arguments about politics. Many of the German students report to her that they find American students uninformed and uninterested in politics, and they really have a pretty contemptuous attitude toward them as a result. What Burns was able to show is that for the German students, a good conversation with somebody you don't know is a nice argument about politics or religion. The American students would never get into a political or even less religious argument, especially with somebody that they don't know very well. So just what the German students were doing to make friends, to get the conversation going, is exactly what had the effect of making the Americans clam up. And Burns describes in particular a young American student who was extremely informed about politics, very involved in political subjects, but would not say what he knew in conversation with German students who were trying to get into an argument. So the German student's conclusion that he was uninformed and indifferent about politics was completely untrue. This often happens when conversational styles differ. That is, what you are able to say is dependent on a shared conversational style. So just as different senses of rhythm might make it impossible for you to get into a conversation, different habits about agonism or eirenism also make it impossible for some people to simply say what's on their mind. If the other person is being, from their point of view, too agonistic, too aggressive, their response is to clam up and they can't say what they know. There are many cultures in which lively opposition is regarded as the most interesting conversation. So in addition to Germany, we could talk about France, Greece, or Spain as examples of countries where you might find this. An American student, a student in one of my classes, her name was Joanna Rebzinski, recalled her year spent as an exchange student in France, and this is the way she put it. During one dinner, my host mother ran through a litany of subjects, changing them every time I agreed or when there was general agreement. She would bring up one controversial topic after another, looking to start a heated intellectual debate over dinner. I'm going to use Italians and Italian Americans again as an example of a culture in which dynamic opposition has positive value. This is a field note written by Andrea Tellerico. She was commenting here on an interchange that had taken place in our class. She writes, "I find it amusing how the last girl to raise her hand in class today discussed how in the Italian family, voices would be raised and objects would be thrown in an intense discussion over which television show to watch, whereas in the British household, a serious disagreement could be undertaken without any apparent show of emotion or distress. My Italian-American family is much the same as the Italian family. My friends have often crept up to my room in fear when the screaming begins and don't understand or believe me when I stress that what's going on is no big deal." Andrea, in fact, sees advantages to her Italian-American family style. The way she put it is, we always know how each other feels at all times. And that's a very interesting point. Again, when conversational styles differ, there's an inclination to feel negative about the other style. So I'm sure some of you listening may be thinking, what a way to live. You know, I wouldn't want to be in a family that's yelling at each other all the time. But the other side of that is, who would want to live in a family where you don't know what's going on with people, where they're not telling you what's on their mind? A Japanese woman who was actually very happily married to a Frenchman recalls that she spent much of the first 2 years of their relationship in tears. He was frequently trying to start arguments with her, And she found it so upsetting, she kept doing her best to agree, to be conciliatory, and that, and of course, complementary schismogenesis would set in. That would make him even more insistent on pushing and pushing till he found a point on which he could get her going. Finally, she lost her control and began to yell. And rather than being angered, which is what she would expect because yelling is so unacceptable, he was overjoyed. Provoking arguments was his way of showing interest in her, letting her know how much he respected her intelligence. And so when she finally yelled back, he said, "Now I feel we're really close." Again, I'm going to refer to the study by William Corsaro and Thomas Rizzo of nursery school kids because it really captures these cultural patterns. They describe a conversational ritual that they observed rather frequently, several times a week, in the Italian nursery school. And they have a name for it. They call it discussione, which is discussion, but of course it has a different overtone in Italian. This is how they describe what happens. The children are quietly drawing with felt marking pens. A boy, Roberto, makes a display of searching for a red marker. Making sure that everybody at the table is watching, he tries and discards all the red markers at his table, and then he gets up and he takes one from another table. The children at the other table either don't notice or, more likely, they pretend not to notice. But before long, a girl at the second table, Antonia, asks loudly, "Where's red?" And she makes a show of searching for a red marker and displaying dissatisfaction with all the ones that she and her table mates can find. And then the drama begins. This is how Corsaro and Rizzo describe it. Antonia slaps her forehead with the palm of her hand and shouts, "They robbed us!" This exclamation sets several things in motion simultaneously. Roberto looks up from his work and smiles at the other children at the table. They all catch his eye and smile back, signaling that they know what is about to happen. At the same time, several of the children at the third table look over to Antonia's table and then quickly to Roberto's. So you see they've got an audience. Finally, at Antonia's table, Maria jumps up, points to Roberto and shouts, "It was Roberto!" Immediately, Antonia, Maria, and several other children march over to Roberto's table. Just as they arrive, a girl at the table, Luisa, grabs 7 or 8 markers, including the one Roberto took, and holds them in her lap. Once at the table, Antonia accuses Roberto of stealing the red marker. He denies it, challenging Antonia and the others to find the stolen marker. As Antonia and Maria begin to look for the red marker, Bruna, backed by several other children from the third table, enters the dispute, claiming that Roberto did indeed steal the red marker and that Luisa is hiding it. Luisa shouts, "No, it's not true." But Antonia reaches under the table, grabs the markers that Luisa is hiding. At this point, there is a great deal of shouting, gesturing, pushing, shoving, and the teachers must once again intervene and settle the dispute. And I love this description because it really shows how agonism works, how these kids have staged a fight, and they all know the part that they're playing in it. They've staged this fight the way Corsaro and Rizzo put it is, they'd rather fight than draw. Okay, so those are nursery school kids. I want to give you an example from a conversation among adults. And this example comes from a conversation that was reported by a Greek linguist. Her name is Christina Kakava. And it's based on an analysis of a discussion between two brothers named George and Alkis and Kakava herself, as well as another friend. In the bit I'm going to show you, and I love it because it is such a quotidian, everyday conversational interaction. Nothing special, no big deal. But I think it's a kind of discussion that Americans would be much less likely to have. In this little interchange, there's just a conversation among friends. They're talking about a belt. So George is showing off a belt that he received as a gift. And they get into this animated argument about the color of the belt. So George says, "I've got burgundy shoes, but the belt's got black in it too." And Christina said, "It has black. Let me see." George, "It has a stripe in it that's kind of black." Alkis, "Dark brown." George, "It's kind of dark." Alkis, "It's tobacco-colored, dummy. It goes with everything." George, "Tobacco-colored? What are you talking about? Are you colorblind?" I might just read it in Greek so you can kind of see how it sounds. "Echo ke bordo papuzzi, alehi ke mavro izoni mesa. Echi mavro, yanado. Echi mi ariga mesa pupsilo mavrizi. Café scuro. Psilo mavrizi. Taba ine avto more. And this little word more is kind of interesting. I translated it dummy, but it's just kind of a word that you find in Greek conversation when you're going to disagree with the person you're talking to. Okay, so he says, Taba ine avto more. Paimeola. Ti taba. Akromatopsia echis. I did a study comparing a Greek and English use of language, and using instrumental phonetics, that is, putting the speech through a pitch extractor, I could actually show that the intonation, the music of the speech, had much more extreme rises and falls for the Greek speakers than it did for the Americans. And the result can be very different impressions, so that I think Americans listening to Greeks often get the feeling the Greek's very emotional because of all the ups and downs in intonation. And Greeks can, I think, get the impression that Americans are rather boring and dull because our pitch sounds kind of monotonic to them. So this little conversational excerpt is a good example of how, in a very insignificant, fleeting conversation, agonism or ritualized opposition can be a form of conversational amusement. In many cultures like Chinese, Thai, Japanese, there's actually a negative value placed on the open expression of opposition. Haru Yamada has talked about this in her book, Different Games, Different Rules. Yamada describes a political scandal in Japan where Prime Minister Noboru Takeshita was accused of enlisting the aid of organized crime to stop a public harassment campaign against him that was mounted by political opponents. The harassment campaign depicted Takeshita, quote, as a great leader with integrity and honor matched by no other. Now, you might really wonder, wait a minute, does this sound like attack, harassment? Sounds like praise. Well, the Japanese press described this as homegoroshi, to kill with praise. What Yamada explains is that among the Japanese, you simply could not openly attack someone in direct terms, and so you kind of indirectly attack them by heaping the praise on to such an extent that people know it couldn't possibly be meant, and so it really means the opposite. I said at the outset that in his initial book about agonism, Walter Ong makes a point that agonism plays a much larger role in the social lives of boys and men than it does of girls and women. The greater inclination of boys and men to use agonism or play fighting or aggression is a pattern that anthropologists have observed in cultures all around the world. Anthropologists Beatrice and John Whiting compared children playing in six vastly different cultures, and they did find that in all the cultures they looked at, boys tended to be more aggressive than girls. But they also found that girls were given more responsibility for childcare and domestic chores and spent more time at home with their mothers. A very interesting example they found in Kenya, boys who had no sisters had to take on these roles, and those boys would turn out to be less aggressive than the other boys. And so it's possible, in fact, it's likely, that what you're always dealing with is a combination of cultural and biological influence. And clearly, cultures play a very large role in whether boys or girls are encouraged to use agonism or not. In fact, there's an interesting study by David Ryback, Arthur Sanders, Jeffrey Lawrence, and Marlene Kestenblatt. They asked university students from five different cultures if they would permit aggressive behavior in their children. Those who said yes, get this, Americans, 61%. Chinese, 19%, Thais, 5%. So there was a vast difference as to whether, at least according to what they said, people would encourage their children to be aggressive. The implications of agonism for personal relationships are extreme. If you're married to someone who thinks arguing is a way of being close, and you think arguing shows there's something wrong with a relationship, a failure of connection, you're in for a rather rough ride, as the Japanese woman who was married to a French man found. It's not unusual for couples to disagree as to whether they should disagree in public. So for some couples, a show of spousal support is, if I say something, you don't disagree with me. For other people, disagreeing with each other in public is almost like a kind of public performance. They put on a display as a show of goodwill and how well they get along. You might even say it's a kind of team sport. To sum up, then, about agonism or ritualized opposition, it's a crucial and a fascinating aspect of conversational style. It's a marvelously widespread and creative resource for communicating meaning and interaction. Our habits for using agonism vary in all the ways that conversational style varies, by gender, by region, by culture. The challenge is to understand agonism not only as an expression of intentions, abilities, and personality, but also to recognize it as a fundamental element of conversational style. The next lecture will build on this one by looking at the whole range of aspects that distinguish women's and men's ways of speaking, of which agonism is just one.
After listening to Lecture 8, a student posed this question to Professor Tannen. Why does agonism seem to define the present state of our national politics? Let's listen to the professor's response.
I'm really glad you asked me about agonism. Incidentally, I've written a whole book about agonism, and the book is called The Argument Culture. And I focus there on the use of agonism in our public discourse, in the press, in politics, and in the law. And without doubt, and I'll talk about this in the later lecture about politics, clearly there is more opposition in our public lives now than there was in the past. There always has been a lot, but it's become more agonistic in the sense of ritual, being ritually oppositional. There's always the risk with any kind of play fight that the frame is labile. The frame could be slip from play fight to real fight. And you know, kids that engage in a kind of ritual insults, let's say, of each other's mothers. There are many cultures where boys will exchange insults about each other's mothers. There's always the risk that you could step over the line and really get into a fight. When you tease somebody, playfully insult, you can step over the line and they can really take offense. Now, some of it are the cultural differences that I talked about. You may come from a culture that teases, they don't. But even if everybody agrees that teasing is a good thing to do, you may just hit a sore spot and a person really take offense. Well, I think you can see similar things in our public lives, that agonism, obviously, to an extent, can be very useful. Debates are very useful way of exploring ideas. But if we overdo it, if we have only debate and never move to dialogue, then we can find that the agonism is actually getting in the way.
This ends Lecture 8.